shock is pretty much the guaranteed feeling of most people, as kind of everybody's walking around dazed.
Disbelief as fishermen wait for sockeye and a commercial fishing opener. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, July 5th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, for the first time in years, the state budget might balance out.
It's good for Alaska's economy to have higher oil prices. There's no question about that. Should the current prices hold, we will have our first balanced budget in several years.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. And by Stronghearts Native Helpline, offering peer-to-peer support and resources for Native Americans affected by domestic violence. Safe, confidential, and toll-free, 1-844-7-NATIVE. This message is sponsored by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
At last count, the price of Alaska North Slope crude was hovering just under $80 a barrel. And that's good news for Alaska's economy. Add to that, the legislature's decision to tap into the permanent fund's earnings to pay the bills, and the state is suddenly a lot closer to a balanced budget, as Arasha McChesney from Alaska's Energy Desk reports.
Oil prices are up again.
I saw one day where the Alaska oil price got slightly over $80 a barrel, but we've been in the high 70s for the last couple of weeks.
That's Ken Alper. He's the director of the tax division at Alaska's Department of Revenue. Each time the price per barrel of oil climbs up, Alper has basically the same message.
It's good for Alaska's economy to have higher oil prices. There's no question about that.
But he says prices have to get higher and stay higher to have a lasting impact on the state's budget.
Should the current prices hold, we will have our first balanced budget in several years for fiscal year 19.
That's right. Alaska could have a balanced budget next year if prices stay right around $72 a barrel. Alper calls that number the break-even point for the state's budget. That's the point when it starts bringing in enough revenue from oil to pay all the bills. Up until 2018, that break-even price was a lot higher. But the legislature's decision to draw money from the permanent fund's earnings last session gives the state another $1.7 billion to spend. And now that the state is $1.7 billion closer to a balanced budget, it takes a lot less oil revenue to close the gap. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rasha McChesney in Juneau.
Three dead gray whales have washed up on two different Kodiak Island beaches recently. Mandy Maguro, the Alaska Marine Mammal Stranding Coordinator with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, says the strandings happened within the span of a week. The first report came in June 25th when residents spotted a young gray whale lying on Pasagshack Beach.
It sounded like some of the local residents had been seeing it for a few weeks prior to us receiving the report. And so we were able to work with a local group who is part of our stranding network, and they were able to go out and collect some samples. There is some discussion that the tongue was missing on this young animal, and so if that's the case, we speculate its cause of death might have been due to a killer whale attack.
The Shunack Tribe of Kodiak is partnering with NOAA to assess strandings on Kodiak. The second stranding came just 2 days later in the same area.
We received a second report on June 28th. Of an adult gray whale that was actually fairly fresh dead. That was also in Pasagshack Bay in Kodiak. And we were able to get a veterinarian out to conduct a necropsy on this past Saturday.
Then a third whale washed up a few days later on a different part of the island.
And then on Sunday night, our local network partner sent an email saying that they had received a report of another fresh dead gray whale near Port Lyons. And so on Monday, they were going to go out for us and collect some samples.
Magura says three whales washing up in such a short span of time in the same area is concerning. Preliminary results from necropsies should be back soon, while more detailed reports will take some time. Gray whales are on their annual migration with their young from Mexico, where they winter. They are listed under the Marine Mammals Protection Act. Communities around the Gulf of Alaska are struggling with low sockeye returns, and villages near Chignik River along the Alaska Peninsula are no different. The region is experiencing its weakest recorded run in the last 50 years. Fishermen are stuck waiting for a commercial opener as they anxiously track how many fish are returning to the region. KDLG's Mitch Borden visited Chignik Bay and has this story.
There's really only one thing to talk about in Chignik Bay these days. Where are the sockeye?
Shock is pretty much the guaranteed feeling of most people as kind of everybody's walking around dazed.
Ben Allen, a local fisherman, says there have been slow salmon years before, but nothing like the run failure the Chignik region is currently experiencing. So far, there haven't been any commercial sockeye openings in the region because there haven't been enough salmon to sustain future runs. It's to the point where residents have pulled their subsistence nets voluntarily to try and get every salmon they can up the Chignik River. Luckily, there are two sockeye runs annually, so people are hoping the later run will be a strong one. But Allen says it's hard to stay optimistic.
The ebb and flow of fishing does happen, and you know, you just kind of hope that the next run or the next year is going to be something worth going after, but there's not a lot of hope involved anymore.
Chignik Bay is small. There's less than 100 year-round residents, and like other nearby communities, red salmon is the main source of income that keeps the lights on in the village. The commercial fishery in the Chignik region has been struggling for a while, and the failure of this run is making people wonder what the future holds.
Honestly, we don't know if we're going to still be doing this in 5 years, 10 years.
When I bought the boat and permit, I didn't think it was going to be this much of a struggle, you know, to get things going and try to hand it down to my son, which is, you know, he's young, and I don't want him to hand a big bill, that's for sure.
Billy Anderson is from Chignik Bay and has been a commercial fisherman for most of his life. He says he's never seen a worse salmon season, which is a sentiment echoed throughout the community. And fishermen aren't the only ones concerned about this year's run. So are the biologists monitoring the situation, like Alaska Department of Fish and Game's Don Wilson.
We're worried that we may not even meet the minimum escapement goal for the year.
So far, only around 170,000 sockeye have reached the Chignik River. ADF&G's minimum escapement goal for the month of June was around 300,000. It's too early to know for sure what caused the region's early sockeye run to fail, but there is a hypothesis.
It's very likely that it's related to the warm waters we've seen in the past couple of years out in the Gulf of Alaska.
She's talking about the blob, which was a body of unusually warm water that settled in the Gulf a few years ago. It's since moved out of the Gulf, but it could have caused some of the area's sockeye stocks to crash. Even if the run failure is due to environmental factors, local fishermen are still frustrated, and Axel Copen is one of them.
If it was just a bad run, you know, and we knew our fish were getting through to us, yeah, bad runs happen. But when you got a bunch of your fish being intercepted, you know, just a few miles below you, and you're sitting on the beach and you don't even get to do subsistence, it's hard to take.
Copen's the president of the Chignik Seiner Association. He says fisheries along the Alaska Peninsula catch salmon from mixed stocks that include Chignik sockeye, and some sections have continued to fish even though Chignik's first run failed, which local fishermen want to change.
We're not here just to get our escapement. Yeah, we want our escapement, but we also need to catch fish and make money. We are actually living, breathing people here too, you know, and we need to actually have enough fish to make a living.
It's hard to say how many fish caught along the peninsula are destined for Chignik, according to ADF&G, but the sections that have been open along the peninsula during Chignik's run failure have been limited for the first time ever because of it. Fishermen in Chignik don't think these restrictions are enough, so they're petitioning the Alaska Board of Fisheries to change the way some sections along the peninsula are managed to protect Chignik's sockeye resource. The Board of Fisheries has called an emergency meeting for July and will consider Chignik's request. The five native tribes from the Chignik region are also reaching out to Governor Bill Walker to see if there's any aid the state can offer. For fishermen like Dale Carlson, though, these efforts are necessary, but they don't change anything about the current situation.
As a fisherman, you're always thinking, okay, well, next week, or like I said, the next tide, but we're starting to run out of the next tides and the next weeks here pretty quick.
All people can do now is wait and see how Chignik's late sockeye run turns out. In Chignik Bay, I'm Mitch Borden.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, some new growth at Anchorage's Botanical Gardens on its 25th anniversary.
I had a vision for having orchids, but then we got this donation, so it's all happening like very quickly.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
A review of 5 years of Army Corps of Engineers permits for development in Alaska wetlands shows the Corps has been requiring mitigation for fewer and fewer projects. The analysis by E&E News, a Washington, D.C.-based news organization that covers energy and environment issues, showed that the Corps has allowed the destruction of thousands of acres of wetlands without requiring offsets for that development as it had in the past. E&E News reporter Ariel Wittenberg dug into the details of the apparent policy shift in permitting at the Corps' Alaska region for projects ranging from mines and dams to roads and schools. She joins me today. Hi, Ariel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, what are wetlands? Why do they matter? And what is this concept of mitigation?
Alaska is actually full of wetlands. The majority of remaining wetlands in the U.S. are in Alaska, and that's 43% of the state is wetlands. It's most of the non-mountainous areas. So if you think of bogs, salt marshes, mud flats, moist tundra on the North Slope, that's all wetlands. And wetlands are protected under the Clean Water Act, and that's because they have a number of environmental and ecological benefits. What people might care a lot about is that they can be spawning habitat for anadromous fish like salmon, but they also can help trap pollution, and they hold on to storm water and stop flooding. And actually, in Alaska, you also have a lot of kinds of wetlands that can trap carbon and in that way kind of help stave off climate change. So Alaska is kind of really special in a way that you do have so many pristine, untouched wetlands, and the rest of the country really doesn't. And if you look at other locations around the country, decreased water quality, habitat fragmentation, persistent flooding, you know, all of those are issues that in a lot of cases can be tied back to a historic loss of wetlands. And so when we say that the Clean Water Act protects wetlands, that doesn't mean that you're not allowed to develop in them or destroy them. It just means you need a permit. And basically, if you're going to develop in wetlands, either if it's a house or a mine or anything else, you have to offset that impact. So you have to either yourself restore or preserve similar nearby water resources, or you have to pay someone else to do it.
When did the policy seem to shift at the Corps of Engineers Alaska District, and what did you see in terms of a change in the number of projects required to mitigate?
Right, so we definitely see a big change in 2015. Permit applications that were filed after 2015, we found just 26% of those required mitigation. Applications that were filed between 2012 and 2014, the Army Corps required mitigation for those 73% of the time.
It kind of flipped, right? It was about three quarters had been required in the past, and then it switched to about three quarters that weren't. Is that about right?
Yeah, exactly.
We're talking about Alaska. We have so much land, so much of it is wetlands, and you know the numbers can be sort of mind-boggling, but what are the numbers in terms of acreage?
Right. So, and you're right. I mean, Alaska has, I think, more than 110 million acres of wetlands. So when you hear some of these numbers, it can sound kind of small, because since 2015, the Army Corps required 872 acres of mitigation for 1,900 acres of wetlands destruction. You know, and that seems maybe small when you think about what's 1,900 acres when you're thinking about 110 million acres. But it depends on where they are, and it depends what the development situations are in those localities and the functions of the actual wetlands that are being impacted to really know, you know, is that going to make a difference on the ground?
So have you seen any reaction to your stories or any fallout, I guess, from this reporting at this point?
Yes. So last month, the Army Corps of Engineers headquarters and EPA came out with a new agreement about how to make mitigation work in Alaska, and it kind of puts emphasis on different ways that are already allowed under current regulations that you could make mitigation work even if your project is in an area where there are a lot of untouched wetlands. And that sort of specifically addresses the reasoning that the Alaska District had been using to not require mitigation in a number of cases. They had essentially been saying, well, even large projects, if they're just surrounded by untouched pristine wetlands, they have minor environmental impacts and we're not going to require mitigation. And this memo says, well, if your project, you have to look at the functions of the wetlands that your project is impacting, and there are ways to either look beyond just the little watershed you're in to find other places that might need the offsets more. Or if you're in an area where there are a lot of pristine wetlands, but there's a stream that's been impacted, you know, we'll let you restore that stream instead of restoring wetlands, just so that the overall benefit is to the watershed.
Ariel Wittenberg is a reporter with E&E News, a news organization that covers energy and environmental issues, online at eenews.net. Thanks for joining us, Ariel.
Thanks for having me.
State marijuana tax revenue has reached another new high in Alaska. The State Department of Revenue reported collecting nearly $1.2 million in May. It is the fourth time this year that state tax collections topped $1 million. Cultivation facilities pay the tax, which is imposed when marijuana is sold or transferred from a licensed grow facility to a retail marijuana shop or product manufacturing facility. The department is taking public comment on proposed changes to the way the state taxes parts of the marijuana plant. The move is intended to address some enforcement and industry concerns. Some in the industry have sought more extensive changes to the tax, which they see as too burdensome for growers. Such an overhaul would have to come from the legislature. Spruce beetles may be native to Alaska, but they can still devastate a forest. Over the last 2 years, an outbreak concentrated in south-central Alaska's Susitna River drainage and northwest Kenai Peninsula has affected more than 500,000 acres of forest. It's the worst infestation since the 1990s. Jason Moan with the Division of Forestry says a combination of factors causes a population of beetles to grow to the level of an outbreak.
Spruce beetle favors large diameter, slow-growing trees, and we have wind events or things like that where a large number of trees might be blown over. You know, beetles tend to favor that material. They're able to build up populations in that kind of material.
He says warm summers can also play a role because beetles reproduce faster in warmer weather. It takes 1 to 2 years for the beetles to complete their life cycles, and then when the weather warms above 60 degrees, female beetles begin to take flight in search of a new host tree, sending out pheromones to attract others when they've found one. Larger, unhealthy trees are more susceptible to infestations.
Folks can start, you know, keeping an eye on the spruce that they do have that are not attacked, keeping those watered if they need it, avoiding damage to those trees.
Signs of an infestation include clumps of sap and sawdust where the beetles have bored holes into the bark, as well as pieces of bark scattered at the base of the tree. Discolored needles can also be an indicator, but not always. Moan says once a tree is infested, there's not much that can be done other than to remove it. Pesticides can be effective in preventing beetles before they take flight, but not after.
In the current part of the beetle flight period, which usually runs from late May to somewhere into July, you know, we would just suggest avoiding cutting green trees unless you're going to be processing that soon.
Beetle-killed spruce can be used for firewood and for lumber. Beetles tend to live in the underside of a tree's bark. Moan says that over time, they've served as a natural part of forest ecosystems, making room for healthier, younger trees. But many landowners want to manage outbreaks to limit the amount of destruction to their properties. The Division of Forestry and their partners are currently working to develop new tools to help.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
When the homelands of indigenous groups straddle the border between the U.S. and Canada, traveling back and forth becomes an immigration issue. You would think that countries have similar policies, but it isn't that easy. KTOO's Trip Krause talks with one U.S.-born Tsimshian teacher caught in the mess, fighting to legally stay and work in her ancestral homeland in British Columbia.
Mikey Old Angeli teaches the Tsimshian language, Tsimalyuk, to children and adults in British Columbia.
Tsimalyuk. Who knows how to say tea in Tsimalyuk? Tea. It sounds just like it in English. It's tea. Oh, you're
now, right. She's fighting to stay. Her postgraduate work visa expired July 1st, along with her ability to legally work in Canada. She applied for Canadian citizenship, but was denied twice. The first time, she hadn't taken a required English exam. Her frustration boiled over while talking to an immigration representative.
The Canadian government, as well as the American government, have forced, over a 200-year time span, our people to speak English through physical, emotional, spiritual, and sexual abuse. I have to take an English exam to continue to teach Somaliyah here. And she said, I'm sorry. I don't make the rules. I'm sorry. This is what you have to do.
Still, D'Angeli took the $500 exam. Then, she says, Canadian immigration denied her the second time. It's complicated, but she says it has to do with her husband's immigration status.
So now we're both our rights to be here, be in BC in our people's traditional territory, is being called into question.
We reached out to Canadian immigration officials for this story, but they did not return calls requesting comment in time. Her situation isn't unique. She says Indigenous people such as Gwich'in, Haida, Tlingit, and Coast Salish people also face issues crossing the border.
And it just doesn't get the media attention that all the other border issues do. I've always felt that the northern border between the U.S. and B.C. in particular, the U.S. and also the Yukon, are completely ignored because of all of the focus on the Mexico U.S. border.
D'Angeli grew up on the Nanette Island Indian Reserve in Metlakatla, Alaska. The PhD in Northwest Coast Native Art History moved to British Columbia to focus on teaching Somaliyuk in the traditional Tsimshian territory. She even gave up a tenure-track position at the University of Alaska Southeast to do so.
We should be afforded the same rights as our relatives on the Canadian side to come to the U.S. to live and work as we please.
D'Angeli says First Nation status holders from Canada can live and work in the U.S., but Canada does not reciprocate with U.S.-born natives. In the meantime, D'Angeli's school in British Columbia is on summer break. She'll travel back to Metlakatla to visit friends and family, and Canada issued her a visitor's extension through part of July. Canada's asymmetrical policies don't surprise Damian Lee. He's an associate fellow at Yellowhead Institute, a First Nations Public Policy Center in Toronto.
The irony is that Canada exists because First Nation permission, yet the First Nations are being denied permission by Canada to exercise their current political jurisdiction. To me, that's mind-blowing.
D'Angeli is circulating a petition urging Canada to change its policies and allow U.S.-born Indigenous people to live and work in the Great White North. Until then, things are in the hands of D'Angeli's lawyers and Canadian immigration. In Juneau, I'm Trip J. Krause.
Alaska isn't exactly known for tropical orchids, but that hasn't stopped Anchorage's Botanical Garden from raising them. It's one of many unique projects that the nonprofit has undertaken since opening its doors a quarter of a century ago. In honor of that 25th anniversary, Alaska Public Media's Aaron McKinstry visited the garden to find out more about how they've continued to grow, from adding vegetable gardens to raising more native plants.
Fans whirr inside the greenhouse, helping distribute a blanket of warm air. To the right, a diagonal wall of windows lets in light. Shelves brimming with the green foliage of tropical orchids line the cement walls. Botanical Garden Executive Director Mike Monteruso carefully clasps the stem of a yellow flower between two fingers.
I had a vision for having orchids, but then we got this donation, so it's all happening like very quickly.
Where did they come from?
They came from an individual in Anchorage.
What's more important to their mission than the tropical orchids, he says, are displaying the hardy ones that grow naturally in Alaska. Outside, we find a patch of spotted lady slippers at the end of their bloom. The flowers are tinier and more delicate than their tropical cousins. Right now, around 15 to 20% of the garden's plants are native to Alaska, but Monteruso hopes to increase that number.
What botanical gardens did, you know, decades or even hundreds of years ago is collect local plants and put them on display for education, and that's something that I want to make sure we don't overlook.
He says the garden aims to do two main things: to operate as a museum that preserves, labels, and catalogs plants, and to teach the public about plants and their connection to them. Right now, they're operating a summer camp that teaches kids about nutrition and ecology.
Are you ready? Can you bring me your plate and your bowl and your knife?
A group of elementary-age children stand around a table peeling and cutting multicolored carrots for a snack. On the other side of their tent, pink tubs filled with different soil types sit atop a table. Monterusa says the heart of their curriculum is teaching them to value diversity.
Diversity is, you can imagine, is good in the sense of nutrition. Not only be aware of what's around you and what you can use for food as a food source, but why one thing might be good for at one time and another thing is good at another time, and what the benefits are associated with those.
In the Heritage Garden, created in 2015 to celebrate Anchorage's centennial, giant cabbages grow in the back of a pickup truck. Rows of broccoli are labeled with a skeleton to show that they help build strong bones. The garden donates some vegetables to a food bank and a kids' school lunch program. Others are given to one of the many volunteers, like Kim Sherry, who works in the garden today, deadheading flowers.
I've got a home garden. I've been doing vegetables and perennials and putting in annuals pretty much every year. But there's just always more you can learn to improve your own gardening skills. So I thought this would be a good opportunity to not only get some good information, but give back.
Outside the vegetable garden in the surrounding forest, native plants like forget-me-nots and wild roses fill the forest floor. In the gardens, red fernleaf peonies and vibrant blue poppies bloom. A bumblebee buzzes near an ornamental raspberry bush that's about to flower.
Each flower will have a bee in it, and this whole bank here just is a buzz.
Over the last 25 years, the garden has added buildings and a research plot and expanded their programming.
Gardens around the country have been in place for decades, or if you go into overseas, you'll go to gardens that have been around for hundreds of years, literally. So we're still pretty young, still pretty new, but a lot has happened here in those 25 years.
Monterusso says they're not done growing. He hopes to connect with the other two botanical gardens in Alaska to bring traveling exhibits to the state. And he hopes to start a holiday light event that would turn the boreal forest into a winter wonderland during the darkest time of year. In Anchorage, I'm Erin McKinstry.
Finally tonight, a correction to a story broadcast Wednesday about judges regaining discretion over requiring cash bail for some misdemeanors. While the changes affected certain offenses, it's unclear if they included most misdemeanors. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Dacia Eaton in Kodiak, Mitch Borden in Chignik Bay, Rasha McChesney and Trip Krause in Juneau, and Erin McKinstry in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. The Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium featured open positions include CMAs and LPNs for their primary care clinics in Southeast Alaska. Come work for Search and contribute to your community. Enjoy full benefits, paid time off, and retirement savings. Search is looking for someone like you. For more information, visit search.org/jobs. That's search.org/jobs to apply. This message sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.